Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the School of History podcast at the University of Leeds. And today it is my incredible pleasure to be interviewing a new colleague whose work I'm really, really excited to learn about. And that is Rebecca Darley, Dr. Rebecca Darley, who is our lecturer in global history from 500 to 1500. So quite a bit to get your teeth into there. And I'm really, really excited to learn more, Rebecca, about your research and about the idea of the global Middle Ages. But I just wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your own historical background. What brought you to doing the history that you do?
Hi, John. Thank you. And I'm also absolutely thrilled to be here and to be joining the University of Leeds. It's a great privilege. Yeah, I'm a historian, so my inclination is to tell that story historically. And like I imagine quite a lot of people who join the University of Leeds as students, I did history at school, I loved it, I always enjoyed reading about history. In my case, I allowed various factors to persuade me not to do history when I went off to university. So I started out doing a degree in modern foreign languages, which I enjoyed, but around halfway through my first year, realised was not for me. And at that point, I stopped and changed to do history. And I suppose I put that out there as a message to everyone that you can always change direction and that nothing you ever learn is wasted or useless. It always comes back and finds its way through things. And of course, that history is the right answer.
Right.
So that was a brilliant move for me. I really, really enjoyed the history program. And around that time, because I was convinced I was going to do modern Soviet history because I studied Russian, I picked up a coffee table book about the Byzantine Empire. And I read it and thought, well, that was cool. And here I am about 15 years later, and it's still cool. So there was no great revelation of the early Middle Ages. It just seemed interesting, and I took as many modules as I could in it. But I was also very fortunate around that time to have the opportunity to access the museum collections at the university I was at, which is another wonderful thing that Leeds has got. It's got both the Brotherton Library, but also a huge collection of, close to my own heart, coins. So as an undergraduate, I started hanging out with the coin collection at my university. And that really brought together two of my interests, the Byzantine Empire, the early Middle Ages more generally, and coinage. So by the time I got to my undergraduate degree, I knew there was something I wanted to do there. That led me on to the University of Birmingham, which is a major centre for Byzantine studies, the study of the East Mediterranean across time. And I did my master's there in Greek archaeology because I thought I wanted to understand material cultural approaches a little bit more and bring that more into my work before completing a PhD on joining all of my interests together and adding a new one, Byzantine coins. So coins minted in what is now Istanbul, was then Constantinople, between roughly the 4th and the 7th centuries CE, found in South India. So I thought Byzantium coins and India, what could go wrong? That was my PhD, and I thought it was going to be a simple story. I was going to discover all of these coins, tell a great missing chapter about international trade, and that wasn't the case at all. There weren't very many coins, and there were good historical reasons for that. And what that drew me into was trying to understand the political and economic lifeways of the Western Indian Ocean in the first millennium CE. And so that's where I find myself now, with this collection of research interests that take me from the East Mediterranean to South India, although I'm now finding myself drifting towards Southeast Asia and China and how the Western and Indian Oceans join up, but always coming back to these questions of coins and material culture and the ways in which big political systems really shape the everyday experiences of people.
I think that's something I find really exciting about your work is just that extent, both kind of geographical, but also then the extent of your experiences and interests. So you said, you know, you'd training in foreign languages, but also training in archaeology. And you've worked in museums as well as in universities,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes, after my PhD, I had the wonderful opportunity for about a year to work as curator of the collection of coins at the Barber Institute of Fine Arts, also in Birmingham, which is, I mean, the Institute of Fine Arts is exactly that. It's a mostly modern art collection. But by a series of historical happenstances, it also has the best collection of Byzantine coins in Europe. So it was a real privilege to get to work with that collection. I also got to work on it with my best friend. We were co-curators. It was a brilliant year to spend. We put on an exhibition called Faith and Fortune, which explored the rise of Islam and the rise of Christianity in the early Middle Ages through their coinage. And really, I think, experimented with new ways of using that coin collection to tell historical stories, which is something that I'm still really proud of having been involved in. That was a brilliant experience. At the same time, I was also working for the British Academy on a project about open access. So again, you never know what's going to turn up, and it's never useless.
Exactly. There's always there's always a reason, and there's always
exactly
outputs, to use the terrible term we use now. But that's really fascinating. I mean, to think a bit more about your research, I suppose, I'm really interested that you work with what we as historians often describe as, you know, material culture is the term we use. But I know for a lot of our students, that is a term that needs a bit of unpacking. What would you say kind of material culture is to you, and how does it feature in your research?
I'd say that's always in flux. It's something that I think about very hard. I've been very fortunate to be coming to Leeds from the Department of History, Classics and Archaeology at Birkbeck at the University of London. And I think spending 6 years there in a combined Department of History, Classics and Archaeology, especially working with some of my archaeological colleagues who work on prehistory, has again really helped to think differently about that. Also, so there's a whole lot of complexity there. There's also a core simplicity, which is that it's stuff. And it's that recurrent role of stuff in our lives. You know, we are made of stuff. We live with stuff. We exist by consuming stuff. We read historical texts on stuff. And it's constantly remembering that that thingness about everything shapes every aspect of how we engage with the world and our lives and the past. So in a lot of the studies that I've encountered about Indian Ocean trade, for example, really important questions are not just what sources do we have and what do they say, but where are they? And what has that meant for who has had access to them and who hasn't? And how has that shaped different ways of telling stories about this space?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's such a fascinating set of approaches, I suppose. And I know from talking with students that it's something that tends to really excite people, not only kind of getting to read about things, but also whether it's kind of handling, looking at, or considering the role of objects and things as well, is really exciting. I wanted to ask about kind of your research at the moment. So what's exciting you, or what's, because I know you're working in a lot of different areas. Do you have particular things at the moment that are kind of working their way through your brain and onto paper?
Yes, I mean, always, right? That's we always have. But yeah, especially right now, I had the great good fortune to get a British Academy Wolfson Fellowship grant, which is running now for 3 years from 2020 to 2023. And the focus of that is really writing up these last sort of 10 years of research on the Western Indian Ocean to produce the first synthetic history of the Western Indian Ocean in the first millennium CE. So that book manuscript is working its way towards completion. Deadlines are what we all live by, of course. But that's proving a lot of fun and is a real chance to finally nail things down that I've been working with for years. That's involved me talking about things I never thought I would. I was giving a paper just this afternoon, actually, at St. Andrews about the Palmyran economy and how the ancient city of Palmyra interacted with the Roman Empire, which if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd have gone, definitely not my period. Definitely a bit too far north for me, but it always grows, and that will be part of the book. But that book project is also associated with a whole raft of really exciting opportunities for public outreach and engagement that are part of the fellowship. So I'm really looking forward to those as well. Obviously, COVID has been a bit of an issue there. It's supposed to involve quite a lot of travel to work with collaborators and students in the Western Indian Ocean region, and I still hope to do some of that next year. But perhaps the most interesting part of it for me is the chance to write shortened versions of my book that are focused on specific sub areas of the region that will then be translated into local languages as an opportunity for particularly school age children. So it's pitched at around 14 to 18 year olds to have a chance to think about local sites and objects within their own country or area. And to really think about places like India and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and Ethiopia as parts of an Indian Ocean world, as well as the other identities that these countries have and think of as core to their identity.
That's incredibly exciting. And the idea of being able to make your research kind of accessible to so many people in such a diverse range of places, I think is a really exciting prospect. But it seems that from the kind of work that you've been doing, all of the work that's gone in to make up the book that's kind of coming out of this project, it seems to have involved obviously a vast amount of research. It must involve kind of research in lots of different languages, lots of travel for research as well. I mean, can you sum up in any way what's had to go into it to kind of to come out with this book?
Lots and lots of reading, obviously, and always. Lots of agonizing about not having enough languages or at a good enough level. I think it's also necessary that we all always try and be fair to ourselves and say that time is finite and the possibilities of what we can achieve are finite. This is a battle I have with myself, that wonderful phrase, don't let the best be the enemy of the good. So some of that has gone into it. My core sort of languages of research are really Latin, Greek, and to a certain extent, Tamil. But one of the things about material culture and one of the attractions of it, which also makes it fantastic as a resource for students and for learning, is that, of course, material culture speaks a different set of languages that are about feel and sensation and weight and size. And so the fact that a lot of my research is material is both appropriate to the region. Archaeology is often one of the most important areas of material that we have, but also I think makes this project possible in a way that it wouldn't be if I was trying to engage with much larger volumes of modern source material in various languages. It has indeed involved a lot of travel, and that's been wonderful. Really looking forward to getting back to that, mostly in my case to South India, because thinking back to the PhD that started it all, I did a lot of research in South Indian museum collections and looking at coinage there, but also visiting archaeological sites. The last year, though, the COVID coincided quite well with the point when I really knew that I needed to just close the door and write.
I was going to ask a little bit about, so one of the things that I find fascinating here is, you know, the sheer geographical range of the work that you're doing. And one of the terms that, you know, your work is engaging with, and your teaching at Leeds will be engaging with, and really that there's been so much debate around today, is the idea of a global Middle Ages or the global medieval. What does that mean to you, and how does that figure in your thinking?
That's a really, really interesting question right now. And the honest answer is that I am hugely looking forward to working that out with my students at Leeds. I was asked as part of my teaching this year to offer a lecture on one of the various conceptual courses that Leeds runs on global history, sort of what is global history. And the answer that I gave there, and I think is still my answer now, is that we don't really know. The idea of global history has developed alongside discussions of globalization. So it's become a very popular term, of starting in the 80s and 90s, but really in the last 20 years or so. And as a result, I think there are quite a lot of people who are probably doing global history, certainly who think of themselves, ourselves, as doing global history. And the discussion about what exactly that means, what counts, what the core parameters of it are, has really only started to develop recently. There have been two or three major volumes in the last two or three years about what the global Middle Ages is, how we might conceive of that. And I think it's fair to say all of them have contributed really important ideas, but none of them would claim to have an answer to that question. And one of the courses that I'm hoping to develop at Leeds over the next few years is an MA module on the global Middle Ages, which is going to be my attempt to grapple with this question and think about how we do work that is still meaningful and detailed and rigorous, and that also retains the kind of scope that you need to talk globally. But I would say that for me, some of the core aspects of my own practice, that when I think of myself as being one of those doing it, even if we're not sure what it is, makes me think that, is not just geographical scope. I think it's entirely possible, actually, to do global history on quite small geographical areas, but about thinking about how whatever area you're doing fits into comparative patterns and structures that make it analogous with or translatable to other contexts. Mm-hmm. And I also think, for me, there is something actively political about doing global history. There is something really meaningful about using the past as a way to the past and the study of the past, which has itself supported a range of inequalities in the modern world, to look again at the circumstances of the past and say, could we tell stories differently? Are certain areas left out of stories, and what are the reasons for that? And again, this brings me back to material culture. And famously, in the 18th century, Hegel declared that large parts of the world that did not have narrative written sources had no history. No one would now accept that premise. But I do think there are trends within historiography that, while they would reject it on principle, might still not give attention to areas that don't have written narrative sources. And that's where material culture comes in and is one of many ways, along with oral history and other kinds of social and cultural approaches, to say, how do we tell meaningful stories about people who've been left out of our visions of the past?
I love that you've raised that as well, because I feel like this gets at some of the excitement of studying history at university, which is that, you know, people sometimes think that it might be the case that you'll show up and we'll have all the answers, right? You come into the classroom and we'll just tell you what we know. But the excitement of doing courses like the ones you've described, or ideas like the ones you've described, is that these are, in many cases, open questions, and that with our students, we're exploring them. We're trying to bring students into contact with all of these kind of ongoing debates and really to help them participate in them, which is something I love. I kind of go into third year classes and I say, this week we're going to have a class about something that actually we don't really know very much about. So you can be at the cutting edge of research into this topic. And something I really love about teaching. But that's kind of really a prompt for me to ask you about your own teaching. So you mentioned you've got a couple of modules in the pipeline. You've got some that you're teaching this year. Can you tell us a little bit about what you like to teach and what you're going to be bringing to Leeds?
Absolutely. And the first thing I would say is that that sense of excitement about sharing the new and the cutting edge really resonates with me as well. I think the point about university is that we don't have the answers, but we might be here to try and help people ask different questions. And that's really what I love to do in my classroom. So this year I'm doing a lot of teaching with Leeds first years, which is brilliant because it feels like I'm getting to know the university with them. I'm really enjoying those classes. So I'm running a strand of a module that's about a text dealing with the ancient Indian Ocean, but that is also looking at how people since then have reacted to that text and tried to situate it in the context of British imperialism or Indian nationalism. So that sense that the deep past still resonates in the present is, I think, something that always speaks powerfully to me in my teaching and that I'm trying to communicate. I decided not long ago that I'm less interested as a medievalist in the ways in which people in the Middle Ages were quite like us, which is, I think, quite often a thread in popular history and certain kinds of research, ways in which we can show that they weren't as unsophisticated as we thought they were, which of course they weren't. They had interesting and diverse lives in ways that stereotypes don't think they did. Of course they did. I'm actually much more interested in thinking about the ways in which we are more like the people of the Middle Ages than we think. I think that is, for me, a more thought-provoking place to stand and look at the world right now. I'm also very interested in providing a space for students in my classes to think about the world they're living in and the challenges that they face, for which, again, we don't necessarily have any of the answers. There was a really, really powerful moment for me at Birkbeck, where the pandemic had just hit and I was teaching a diachronic course with four colleagues on the concept of failed states. We were sort of trying to question and challenge this notion of the failed state with comparative examples from the Roman and medieval empires, that would be me, and then three wonderful colleagues who work on decolonization in southern Africa, the post-war reconstruction of Europe and the late Ottomans. And so we'd done this course, and in the very just before the very last session, the lockdown came. And we all convened on Collaborate when all of this was very new and everything was fuzzy and people didn't quite have working cameras. And it immediately became apparent that what we had planned to do in this session was not relevant. But what happened instead was that our students sat there and used what we had discussed throughout the course about ideas of state resilience, ideas of citizen participation, about what it means to believe in the societies that you belong to, what it means to doubt those beliefs. And we're able to think about this incredibly frightening thing that was happening all around us. And I hope that some of the themes that my courses will address will give students at Leeds the chance to do some of that as well. And global is where it's at now, whether we like it or not, whether it's climate change or international income inequality or pandemic. I would really love students to feel that my classrooms are places where the distant past really provides new ways to ask questions about the things that are troubling us right now.
Yeah, and it's so much more than just saying, oh, they were just like us. It's a kind of, it's a lot more, finding things in the past that enable us to look at our own world anew is something I find really wonderful. I was going to ask as a last question just about your teaching. One of the modules that you're running, which really excited me just on reading the name, was Medieval Romans and Afro-Eurasia Today. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Very close to my heart. This is going back to my my Byzantinist origins. So it's a course that picks up on the history of the Byzantine Empire, which is in the title, is actually the medieval Roman Empire. So in the fourth century, the Emperor Constantine moved the capital of Rome officially from Rome to Constantinople. That had previously been the city of Byzantium, but he gave it his own name. He was one of those. So it gets renamed Constantinopolis, the city of Constantine, and goes on to be the capital of the Roman Empire until 1453, when Mehmed the Conqueror, the Ottoman Sultan, takes the city. And one can argue that, in fact, the Ottoman Empire then takes on the legacy of Rome and continues as the Roman Empire until 1917. The Ottomans certainly refer to themselves as the Sultans of Rum from that point onwards. But you know, that bit is definitely later than this course. But what happens in Europe in the 16th century is a real sort of questioning of that Roman legacy that is, I think, very closely related to growing ideas of Western superiority and the assertion that the country, the various countries of Western Europe in their own different ways, are all the real inheritors of Rome. And one of the things that that produces is an absolute rejection of the claims of these medieval Romans to really be Roman. And so they get called Byzantine, this word that now exists in the English language as a term for decadence and complication. You know, a Byzantine bureaucracy is not a nice thing to say about anybody's system. And so by calling it medieval Romans, I really wanted to push back against that particular colonization of the past that the field of Byzantine studies is really grappling with itself at the moment. But I also wanted to think about how profoundly the people of that medieval Roman Empire from about the 6th to around the 11th century created, participated in, or watched the changes that now form a backdrop to the world that seems so obvious that we don't even notice it. And perhaps the biggest of these, and the reason why Afro-Eurasia is the framing of this, is that when the course starts in the mid-6th century, the Mediterranean is still, if not entirely politically united as it had been under the Romans, is still, to all intents and purposes, a very culturally and economically united space. In contrast, Northern and Western Europe are very much out of that picture. They're doing something very different. This core locus of a coherent civilization is the shores of the Mediterranean, Southern Europe, West Asia, and North Africa. And by the end of this period, there is instead a sort of diagonal line that cuts through the Mediterranean, on one side of which is a set of still fairly culturally coherent Christian cultures, and on the southern side of which is an increasingly culturally coherent set of Muslim cultures. And now I think for most people, that is sort of the unexamined backdrop to the world as we know it. It is geopolitics today. There's North Africa and the Middle East there. There's Western Europe and increasingly sort of Central and Eastern Europe up there. And those are kind of blocks of similarity. And this module is about exploring how that has not always been the case, is not actually as obvious as a lot of sort of simple geopolitical analysis tries to make it out to be today, that actually there are deep similarities and ties that cut across or obviate that diagonal line. But also to look at how this empire that gets ignored, forgotten about, and denigrated as a kind of irrelevance. At best, the Byzantine Empire preserved a bunch of Roman texts so that other people could use them better later. Was actually a key political player in all of this and was central to some of the negotiations that created, for good and bad, the ways in which Christianity and Islam have interacted ever since.
That sounds really great.
If I always float your boat, yeah. Come and join the module.
I always come away from these conversations being like, can I sign up? Can I join in? But that's really fantastic. Dr. Rebecca Darley, thanks so much for speaking with me today. It's been absolutely brilliant meeting you and getting to know more about your research. And I know that people will be very keen to know more too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, John.